Earthwatch. This is Earthwatch on WBAI New York. And coming up in barely 120 seconds from now will be Jim Freund with Hour of the Wolf. There are so many of you calling, I cannot get to you in a polite time limit such as this. But please drop me an email at rknight, R-K-N-I-G-H-T at WBAI.org, and I'm sure we'll continue this conversation next week or at our next opportunity, or call the switchboard at 212-209-2800 tomorrow between my marathon morning and miraculous evening with Greg Palast on 5 o'clock shadow. And me doing Esther this morning at 6 a.m. on Wake Up Call. I love you. And part of life is the stress of differences. And there are some old guys who are dead in the soul who attack us at every moment, who almost destroyed the station. And then there are you who preserve and expand the station. And I guess you can pretty much guess whose side I'm on. This is Earthwatch. Thank you for listening. I'm Robert Knight. Drop me an email. rknight@wbai.org. Coming up, Jim Freund, Hour of the Wolf. I'm out of here. See you in the morning at 6 a.m.
Please listen. I've got one or two things to say.
Tell us.
How do we feel? About Congressman. John Lewis. Addressing the assembly. At this time. Look, you've got it all wrong. You don't need to follow me. You don't need to follow anybody. You've got to think yourself. You're all individual.
And you are tuned to listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio, New York City. WBAI at 99.5 FM. And Earthwatch with Robert Knight was brought to you live with portions on recording. Well, please bear with me as we go through technical difficulties trying to set up. Somebody has moved the folder with the magic music that we opened the show with. Ah, here we go. Let's wolf. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a Wednesday night, Thursday morning program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. Coming up this morning, an interview with Mary Robinette Kowal. Stay tuned. Okay, why are we howling again? I don't get this thing sometimes. At any rate, good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf. As previously mentioned, my name is Jim Freund. Okay, now, I have, it's all the way over there. Pardon me while I get my stuff set up. I didn't have a chance earlier, so I can properly introduce this morning's show. Now, if you're a regular reader of science fiction and fantasy, you probably don't need any kind of an introduction for Mary Robinette Kowal, but otherwise you might. Well, let's just start with, she's wonderful. She does all this stuff. She has all these things going on at once, an amazing talent, a nice person, and, but I don't want to just go by that, so I figured I'd call up the Wikipedia entry so I could bring up some of the highlights. Okay, professional puppeteer, right? Okay, we're not talking like, you know, sock puppets here. She creates puppets and has worked with the Jim Henson Workshop, which I didn't realize, but I'm seeing that here. She has and done a lot of shows, and if you're lucky enough to catch one of her readings, she's doing one at the KGB Fantastic Fiction Series, in fact, in December, unless I'm mistaken. She occasionally treats people to her puppetry there. She knows the history of puppetry, the different styles and all that, shadow puppetry, all kinds of things. As a writer, let's see, well, in 2009 on this program, she read a short story called Evil Robot Monkey. It was then nominated and won the Hugo Award for that year, also nominated for Want of a Nail, which won the award. Oh, gee, like the day after. No, that was last year. She was nominated for a short story this year, and that was the night before the interview that you're going to hear. But in this particular case, did not win. But it is not just a thing to say it's an honor to be nominated, because My, it really is. The Nebula Award, as I like to point out so often, and we've done a number of, broadcasts, a number of the interviews that I did this year at the Nebulas, our peer award, the Hugo Award, somebody, I think it was Sydney Smith, somebody gave me a very good metaphor for what the Hugos are. They're not the People's Choice Award because they're not that far down, but they are a popularity award from the people who really read the stuff and care about the stuff, but it is from the fandom. The Nebula Award is from the Science Fiction Writers of America, and that brings us to another point in the career of Mary Robinette Kowal. She was the vice president and for 2 years before that, the secretary of SFWA. And you will hear us discuss SFWA to a certain extent. She has two novels out, with a third coming out, I think, late this year. It is, in essence, a trilogy. And imagine Regency fiction, that is to say, books, stories set in the Regency, stuff like Jane Austen and all that, with magic involved, okay? Imagine that. And then imagine that there is, in the old sense of the word, glamour involved. So we're in the same territory, but not the same place as the writings of Susanna Clarke with Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, and to a lesser extent, both a, you know, similar era to Naomi Novik with her Temeraire novels, which are so wonderful. But this is Jane Austen territory. So be aware of that. Now, if I sound like I'm totally thinking of something else, I am, very briefly. I need to call up on my little tablet here some information about the next NERSIF reading, because it's actually a week from tomorrow. We're having a very special reading this month. Roz Kaveny, who is a critic and writes wonderful analytical books about science fiction and film and television, probably the definitive book on Buffy, nonfiction book on Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and Deborah Grabian, who has been on this show. She was on several years ago. Roz is coming all the way from London. Deborah hails from San Francisco. She writes basically murder mysteries based on the child ballads. You know all those Steel Eye Span songs that I play? That's them. Okay, so stories like Thomas the Rhymer and all that. There's enough blood and gore in all of those child ballads to suit any novelist, but she is the one who does it best and does it well. And we'll have the evening hosted by Veronica Shanis, Professor Veronica Shanis here of CUNY, who is par excellence. Now, we normally hold this thing at the Soho Gallery for Digital Art. Oh, by the way, and one or both of these people will be my guest on the show next week. But we're not going to be doing that next week because of a double booking, or a late booking, actually, on the other side. And so we are going to be going to an absolutely new space called 440 Studios, which is, and within those studios is a space called the White Box, which is, well, actually, I think it's more of a rehearsal space than a performance space. And basically, it's at 440 Lafayette Street. That's why it's called 440 Studios. It's directly across the street from the Public Theater. So I hope that you can join us. Admission is free. We as always, we ask donations. And it starts at 8, not at 7. Okay, I do not have the press releases out on this yet because information is changing all the time. I'm going to be working on some of it tomorrow. The performance starts at 8, but we'll try to get together for dinner, possibly 6, 6:30, somewhere nearby. We haven't worked out where. So to find out all the details, either send me an email and join my mailing list or ask me to tell you about this one event, and that would be Jim, J-I-M, at ourwolf.com, H-O-U-R-W-O-L-F, or if you join the, if you're a Facebook person, and you can join the Facebook group. I'm not sure if you have to join the group to read it. I don't think you have to. I make everything public. And in the Facebook group, we will keep you up to date on where and when we will all be meeting. And more information on this next week. Okay, so I've gotten all that out of the way, but I wanted to make sure that this was mentioned for those people who are going to show up at our usual venue on Thursday at 7, and wrong, it's going to be at a different venue Thursday at 8. Okay, getting back to Mary. It's a long interview and a very entertaining one. If I start it right now, I'll barely have time to play my outro. So I'm going to shut up and let's get to it. And the time and place are May 20th of this year at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. This was on the Sunday, the previous Saturday night, were the Nebula Awards. And even though it's 3 o'clock on that Sunday, this is probably the fourth or fifth interview I'd conducted that day. Earlier that day, I had Joe Haldeman, which I broadcast 2 weeks ago, and 3 weeks ago, rather, and so on and so forth. Just over the weekend, I conducted about 15 interviews, and this was the last of them. And Mary and I were both tuckered out, but not so much that we didn't have a lot of interesting and fun stuff to talk about. Okay, Mary having been on the board of the Science Fiction Writers of America that put on the Nebula Awards, it was her turn to say, thanks, I've done my bit, I'm stepping down now. So you'll hear, so just to give you that much information about the background of what it is that you're going to be hearing. Boy, am I glad I started that prematurely because it started howling again on the wrong thing. And there we go. Now there's only one choice for it to play if it decides to play it. And okay, so again, set your Wayback Machines for May 20th of this year, Washington, D.C., at the Nebula Awards, 3 p.m.
I don't know the how many interview that I have done this weekend, but it has been a fabulous weekend.
Oh, good.
And this will be, I don't know if it's my last. I'm here through tomorrow. Not through tomorrow, leaving tomorrow.
Yes.
But what better way than with Mary Robin at Kowal? Did I finally get it right?
You did.
Okay, yeah. I because I remember you said it's like Kowalski, but don't ski.
Yeah.
Something exactly along those lines. Yes. And I actually got to correct somebody.
Excellent.
Who should have gotten it right. I won't tell you who it was. It is Sunday, so everybody here is in a state of, afterglow,
mm-hmm,
or exhaustion.
Or both.
Or both. It has been an really cool weekend. I've really enjoyed this.
Good.
Connie Willis, blah, blah, blah. What can one say? I did another interview with Connie. You cannot get a bad interview from Connie.
No, she's one of the smartest, most genuine people that I've ever had the pleasure of meeting. And, you know, I mean, even her, with an acceptance speech, she can make me cry.
Yeah. I actually did find myself welling up a little bit. She did this comic kind of a thing,
mm-hmm,
and it was very light and all that. And as she was finishing, I realized, I breathed in a little, and I realized all of a sudden, wait, was there a little something?
Yes.
Caught in there, and I thought, oh my God, if I don't watch it, I'm going to weep.
I see nothing wrong with weeping.
You know, well, men weeping openings, other people have a problem with.
But
so.
You see, that used to be a sign of manhood, was that, you know, until very recently, men weeping was a sign of manhood because it meant that you were emotionally connected and had depth. And the inability to weep was considered a flaw because it meant that you were shallow and were not touched deeply and did not have great passion. And in order to be manly, you had to be passionate.
Yeah.
So
I think there's also an American thing in there.
Probably.
That American men don't weep as openly, because I've seen certainly people from other cultures.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Who will just practically break out into tears.
Yeah, but if you read, you know, Three Musketeers, they cry, you know, they are.
But, yeah.
You know, and in, you know, actually Pride and Prejudice, I'm going to go out on a limb here. I'm almost positive that there is a scene in which there is a reference to tears in Darcy's eyes. It's one of Austen's heroes, but I remember hitting that and being, you know, at first thinking in modern terms that it meant something different, but once I had a better understanding of the Regency, and understanding that actually that meant that he was a passionate and manly guy. And it is funny how those things change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. It is. I'm just thinking, okay, I should be talking first about your stuff.
But
I just want to ask you, and we can even re-edit a little, which comes first, the Austen or the Cole, your favorite Pride and Prejudice.
And that is really tough. That's a really
which
tough thing.
Which of your fingers are your favorite fingers?
I mean, the thing is that, you know, the Colin Firth adaptation, because it's a miniseries, they're able to go into so much more depth and really get all of the family dynamics and everything. So that one is probably the favorite because of that.
And her. I'm blanking.
I was having the same problem.
Half a second, and it's awful. And I've spent, by the way, all of the King's Speech for them to have a scene together.
Mm-hmm.
And they do for like a second.
Yes.
Which I thought was a little bit disappointing. I wanted there to be...
Yeah, but it wouldn't have been.
Just a quick moment.
Yeah. But, you know, I have to say that, to my surprise, the Keira Knightley version, I would not put that as my favorite, but I was surprised. I was surprised, and actually, you know, my favorite Mr. Bennett is from Lost in Austen.
Really?
Yeah, that Mr. Bennett, I thought, captured the humor and compassion of the Austen Bennett.
Yeah,
you know, and his. Is the resignedness to having the very silly wife, and he was much more sympathetic than I think many of the
which
other.
Which I thought was it Brenda Blethyn did in the Keira Knightley version, but I thought Donald Sutherland was nothing to sneer at. I was shocked.
True. Absolutely,
I was shocked. You know, my mind went back to MASH, and I thought, no, that's not the same man.
Yeah, no, he did it. He turned in a fine, fine performance.
He really did. Yeah, I'm stuck now. So I've got to look up on IMDb. I am so ashamed that I don't have her name. And I saw her on Broadway in Coast of Utopia by Tom Stoppard.
Jennifer Ely.
Absolutely, Jennifer Ely.
I was coming up with Jennifer, and I was blanking on the last name, and I was doubting Jennifer.
And I actually was almost at the Ely. I remember that it was an unusual E-H-L-E, that it was an unusual spelling and name. But But I thought she brought all the intelligence, yes, all the glory. Keira Knightley was not bad.
Mm-hmm.
People were waiting to dump on her.
Yeah. No, I thought the scene where she got the letter about Kitty running away was really, really nicely handled.
Yeah.
I mean, overall, from both of them, both sides.
Yeah. What's your favorite Austin?
Persuasion, hands down.
Yeah. That's it for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. I have come into this backwards, totally backwards. I started with the Colin Firth, Jennifer Ely production.
Mm.
It was my first exposure to Austin.
Yeah.
And I, at that time, I didn't know I liked adaptations of, I'm going to be very crude here, adaptations of girls' books.
Right. You know, and it's funny, a lot of people...
I didn't realize that it was a comedy.
Yeah, well, and
until I watched it.
The thing is that a lot of people, you know, there's the girls' books and boys' books, and I talk about my own work and say they're much more girls' books than boys' books, but I'm... And this says something about, not just about me, but about our culture, that the fact that I'm surprised that boys like it is actually sad. Because, you know, when you get down into it, what it's about is, it's about relationships, it's about conflicts. There's certainly drama in these things.
Yeah.
You know, in Sense and Sensibility and Pride and Prejudice, there's... you know, there's horse chases, and granted, a lot of these things happen off stage, but they're there. And ultimately, I think one of the things that fiction and one of the reasons that Austin connects to people who do think of them as girls' books is because what she's ultimately doing is talking about the human condition, and she's talking about it in this very intimate way. And it's all about, you know, how people respond to each other. And yes, they are comedies, although that's not why I read them. I think they're funny, but I don't read them for the humor.
Yeah, no, well, I'm reading them unabashedly for the soap.
Yeah.
I love the relationships. I like the thing. I would say that after, you know, six stories, I do get a little bit confused between the Bennets and the Dashforths and which one was the one that had... you see, now I can only think of Pride and Prejudice, and I'm forgetting the ones.
Sense and Sensibility. Which is the one, yeah, with the Dashwoods.
Yeah.
And then.
Dashwoods, I said Dashforth, you see. So there's something else with the Dashforth, and I can't think of.
Oh, I don't know.
Probably not a Regency work.
Yeah, so then there's Emma, and so Persuasion, Sense and Sensibility, Pride and Prejudice, Emma. A lot of people like those because they are. What she was doing to a certain degree initially was poking fun at the Gothic romances, and so mm-hmm. so there, these parodies are of course much more broadly drawn than some of the later books, and so, but that being broadly drawn sometimes makes them more accessible for people, and they're funnier, you
yeah.
know, they are funnier. So if you're reading for the comedy, those are ones that a lot of people particularly
I guess I'm not doing it for the comedy then. I have simply gotten into the mannered stories and all that,
mm-hmm.
and from that has led, now I'm in the depths of the degrade with Downton Abbey, the third season.
Yes.
The third season cannot come soon enough.
So true.
And they're not going to harm Maggie Smith. That was all bad rumor. This is becoming more and more essential
mm-hmm.
to people. When I began Hour of the Wolf, when Margot Adler began Hour of the Wolf in 1972,
mm-hmm.
and I was her fanboy, an engineer and occasional co-host,
mm-hmm.
science fiction was just a ghetto. Science fiction was that, beforehand it had been that Buck Rogers stuff.
Right.
It then was raised all the way up to that Star Trek stuff. Moved on to that Star Wars stuff. And today, for quite a few years, I'd say I do a show about science fiction, it's like, oh, like flying saucers.
You know, I still get people who say, oh, I used to love that when I was a kid. Like, mm-hmm.
Oh, well, yes, that I still get.
You would still like it now if you were reading adult works of science fiction instead of, you know.
Well, that is, I would say, when I create my FAQ, the two biggest questions, the first question point is, I used to read that. And then the question that follows that is, who do you recommend how do I get back into it after I've, you know, happily scowled at them and saying, oh, you're missing good stuff.
Yeah.
And you can, and my, you know, do I tell them about Nora Jemison? Do I tell them about Stan Robinson,
yeah,
if they're into
I always
the
find
hard
out
stuff.
Exactly. I always find out what people like to read on, you know, with
outside.
Yes. It's like, well, what are you reading now? And then I try to match them with something that is has a similar tone, but is doing, you know, exploring the world of science fiction or fantasy. And, you know, I call it the gateway drug.
Ooh, very nice.
Yeah. Which is one of the reasons that...
Without any reference to Fred Pohl in there.
No, of course not.
The Nebula Award-winning gateway series,
yes,
of novels, yes.
But, I mean, that's one of the things that's been great about Harry Potter, the Twilight series, that these are gateway drugs. They get people interested in the genre and break down some barriers,
yeah,
and you know, preconceptions about what it is. And then it eases people in. Hunger Games is one of the best things to happen for the genre.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know?
Absolutely.
I'm so excited about
young
that.
Young women and some boys,
mm-hmm,
are definitely going to be just brought into the field. That's the other side of, I used to read that, what do I read now?
Mm-hmm.
And it's, oh my God, I just saw that movie. Mm-hmm. What is that stuff?
Yeah, exactly. Gateway drug.
Yeah, yeah, well put, mm-hmm, well put. And gateway drugs for adults.
Yes.
There aren't, I don't know, they say I haven't quite seen quite as many gateway drugs for adults. There have been a few.
Well, see, that's the beautiful thing about YA, is that it is for...
Yeah, it is for everybody.
Yeah.
It is for... It's not... When
well,
it says
it also,
young adult...
And it also is because people who are writing YA are often used to needing to be clearer. You know, adult writers can sometimes say, I'm going to be opaque. And and it's still... It's just as annoying and hard to read, but... but if you're trying to introduce someone to a new genre, you don't want them to have to go through that additional barrier of trying to understand the story structure and all of that, you know. So having something that, and not, I should say, not all YA has particularly simple structure. It's just that it is,
can
it
be
is
very
a,
complex.
Yes, it is a benefit that when you're, you know, to something like Hunger Games.
Yeah. Lucid, I think, might be a good term.
Lucid, yeah. That they, you know, that you don't, when you're trying to bring someone into the genre, having something that is more accessible is, you know, you don't want to frighten them off.
Yeah. Now, let's, I think we've done the official CEFWA,
right,
part of the interview.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how long the puppeteering and theatrical part of the interview will be, other than what are you doing, what have you been doing in that right now, or is this now an opportunity that you're going to be able to do some?
Yeah, it's we
have many hats to cover.
Yes.
Here there's the audiobooks, there's the acting, there's the puppeteering,
mm-hmm,
and then we're going to get to, oh, do you write?
You know, the puppetry,
a lot of my interviews start badly, and then they pick up. And then at the end of it, I think, okay, now let's record the beginning. Sorry, go on.
So with puppetry, you know, for your listeners, I'm a professional puppeteer, and I just moved from Portland, Oregon to Chicago 3 weeks ago at the time of this recording. And so because of the move, I wasn't doing a whole heck of a lot of puppetry before we left. I built a couple of things, but it was largely confined, you know, very, very small projects, very short-term things. I built a puppet for John Scalzi of Papa Fuzzy, which is one of the characters in his book, Fuzzy Nation. And, you know, that's this realistic for a fictional character, alien creature that looks something like a Maine Coon cat that can walk on hind legs, vaguely. But, you know, going for video realism which drops it firmly into the uncanny valley.
And some people, by the way, can watch the construction on these puppets on Twitter.
Yes,
and
yes.
And various places, yes. Facebook and Twitter.
Yeah, I usually post process shots on my website. And then on Twitter, the thing I delight in is telling you exactly what I'm doing in a given moment without providing any context, which when I'm in a really heavy build, you know, can often result in things like, I'm scooping out the baby's face before moving on to work on the eagle balls. You know, and these are all things I'm doing.
Yeah.
Special effect. You have to scoop the baby's face out. It makes sense.
Without being gory.
Without being gory.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just styrofoam. So I'm hoping that Chicago will offer me some more opportunities. It's a bigger theater town than Portland. I have, you know, contacts, and also when I rotate off the board with CEFWA, it will be, you know, that will free up time, because, you know, when you move to a new location, you have to pound the pavement with the portfolio to start picking up gigs.
Yeah, but there's great theater.
It's fantastic theater
in
Chicago.
It's adventurous.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of what makes New York theater so great is that it's been tested in Chicago, the second city, first.
Yeah, the out-of-town tryouts for Broadway that happen in Chicago.
Either Chicago or Boston.
Yep.
Actually, they start in Chicago,
mm-hmm.
then they get a little bit polished in Boston, and then Broadway.
Yeah.
Except in Smash, I went straight to Boston. I don't know why, but anyway.
Yes. So I'm hoping that I'll be doing more. I'm truly doing much, much less puppetry than I would like to right now.
I kind of itch a little. I figured that there was that yearning,
mm-hmm.
with all that volunteer, that important volunteer work that you were doing.
Yeah, well, for the...
And so many things that you're involved in.
Yeah, I mean, for the most part, those two things, you know, that could all coexist, you know. Certainly at the beginning of my terms, I was definitely heavily doing heavy, heavy puppetry. But as the writing has taken on more of my creative life, I find that when I am designing a puppet show, I tend to, my writing productivity drops dramatically. Mm-hmm. And vice versa, you know, when I'm writing heavily, the urge to do puppetry, you know, that creative, I need to get my creative jolly somewhere, and I'm apparently not particular on which one it is, but whichever one I'm doing, it uses that same energy, and so the other one suffers from that.
How about the voice acting?
Again, you know, really, my life has been about moving for the past several months.
Yeah.
So I actually had a project that I was very excited about that I had to withdraw from because I just, you know, I was... Between packing everything and then also dealing with book tour, and then we had some health things with my in family, you know, this year has not been my most productive year.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I say that having written two novels,
and therein lies a segue. And this is something I am so upset about at not having realized. That you have two novels.
Mm-hmm.
I darn well knew about the first. I knew about the various short stories. I'm following them, and I haven't figured out how to follow Twitter.
Uh-huh.
And Facebook is a black hole of time that
yes.
I post on and don't go to.
Yeah,
I'm hit and run Facebooker, even though I have two groups on it. So I just didn't realize that you had a second book, and somebody in the middle of an interview says, well, Mary's second book is like, what? You an advance copy? No.
I only got two advance copies.
Yeah, well, I didn't get any arc or anything.
Couldn't send you one if I didn't have it.
Yeah, well, you know, the least they could do is send me an EPUB
yes.
or a PDF or something. Which I guess it's not fair to then say who published that right after, but who did publish?
That's from Tor Books.
It is Tor.
Yeah.
Oh well, actually, that explains a lot. Without putting down any person, they have been publicist lists. They in terms of chief running officer in the publicity department for a little while, and they're in a period of transition with publicity, so that actually totally explains it.
I know that they ran out of them.
Yeah, but send me an email and tell me, did you know that Mary Robin Aqual has this new novel?
Yes.
And to which the answer is, no, I'll call her right away, you know, if nothing else, or can you people send me a PDF,
mm-hmm.
or simply, you're doing a book tour, or what?
That
information,
yes.
they could just send an email, even mm-hmm. when they run out of hard copy. And I know, by the way, well, there have been times that I could walk into Tor Books and they hand you a shopping bag when you go in, and mm-hmm. they say, here's the advance copies and the, you know, you can't take any of the file copies, the advance copies. One time I walked out with, like, this very heavy shopping bag that, like, broke on the way to the elevator, and somebody looked up and said, another one!
Yeah,
so
it's dangerous.
It's not that they're stingy.
No. So I'm sorry that you didn't get a copy.
Yeah, well, no, I'll end up getting a copy if I have to buy the damn thing, which is fine. What I don't have yet, which I will get at some point soon, is an autographed copy, which is more to the point. Because I certainly have an autographed copy of the first book.
Well, I will be in New York on December 19th reading at KGB.
Okay.
So we can definitely make arrangements then.
So that just ruined my next question off mic, which was, so when are you going to read for the New York Review Science Fiction readings? And Ellen and I, we don't overlap, but you will do a radio show at that point.
Yes.
A live
yes.
one, maybe.
Yes. I would love that.
Yeah, okay, good. Because I haven't had you on the air live, have
yes,
I?
Yes, you have.
I did. Mm-hmm. That's right. But it was at 5 a.m.
Yes.
At my original slot before I got bumped. And we have a new program director in 2 weeks.
Oh, wow.
I found out last night.
Oh, good heavens.
In the email, and through rumor, but apparently it's been confirmed. So it's quake time. Although, I looked at the guy's Facebook page, and number one, he had a Facebook page.
It's promising.
It is. And number two, he likes books and movies and music.
Good.
So it won't be all political. So maybe I won't. So maybe I'll be in. And I liked a lot of the things that he liked.
Oh, good.
So yeah.
Good. Well, I hope that works out.
Yeah. So hopefully I'll still have a show. Now in its 41st year.
Good heavens.
Had the 40th anniversary in January mm-hmm. of Hour of the Wolf, and my 45th anniversary of working at WBAI on May 1st.
Wow. Ouch. Well, congratulations.
Yeah, or
condolences.
Yeah. Yeah.
I would prefer to focus on the positive.
The positive is wow.
Yes. That's a long career.
It really is. The other side of it is, so when are you going to earn a living so your spouse can spend her time writing?
Oh, well, there's that.
That's the other side of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So.
I understand that.
And nobody says that. I just know it.
I have never thought that.
Yeah. Yeah, but I have.
Yeah, well, that's...
I have had the honor of having an artistic bohemian life,
mm-hmm.
which is wonderful. Now it's her turn.
And she's such a talented writer.
She is. Barbara Krasnoff is mm-hmm. a very good writer. She's
yes.
written some dynamite short stories. And all of us expect a good novel from her.
I do, too.
One needs the time, though. She needs the time. And it's hard to do. She works a real job.
Mm-hmm.
It's a job involving writing, but it's not literary.
Yes. And you know, it takes the energy away.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. She likes her job, but that's not the point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
But let's talk more again.
Okay.
I keep digressing. And besides, she may walk in on us any minute.
No, I think she's done.
No, I meant
Barbara. Yes.
No. She about 45 minutes till she shows up. But anyway, let me make sure. Yes, I actually have filled up 2 4-gig cards with interviews so far. So so I have to take them, put them up to the cloud, and go to the next. So I have one ready. So anyway, we touched on the. Okay, yes, I know where I was going. The first book mm-hmm. came out. It doesn't seem that long ago.
It was 2 years ago.
It was a whole 2 years yeah. ago, yeah. And we actually recorded an interview at my house.
Mm-hmm. It was August of 2010.
Yeah. And the book was a joy.
Oh, thank you.
I really did like it. Again, I have now fully become a Regency fan.
Yay!
I haven't read Georgette Heyer, should I?
You know, and, you know, a lot of the Regency fans are going to be shocked by this. I have only read part of one of her books.
Ah. But that says something. It didn't pull you in immediately.
No, but what I understand is that she wrote so much that that she has books of a lot of different styles within the Regency, and so I think that I may have started with the wrong one.
Ah, yeah, well, that's always, again, that wonderful word that you used earlier, which is the gateway.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I guess we all have to
yeah.
find out.
But so I think that she is worth reading, and certainly she did a lot to establish Regency as a genre, but I need to give another try. And part of it is also that when I am writing the books in this universe, I don't want to read people who are outside of that period. And Georgette Heyer is, of course, a contemporary writer. I mean, she was writing earlier in the 1900s, but she is not contemporary with Jane Austen, and I don't want to confuse the voice. And
she was writing period.
Yeah, exactly. And I want to read primary.
Yeah. So, but Shades of Milk and Honey,
mm-hmm.
it's sort of hard to say exactly what, is it period, is it contemporary?
I call it historical fantasy.
Yeah. And can you give people a little taste of, just a précis of what it is, so
sure.
that we can then move on to Glamour Glass, right?
Glamour in Glass.
Glamour in Glass.
Yeah.
You see, I'm cheating looking at the computer without my eyes. I haven't gotten my copy. So Glamour in Glass. So
yes.
Shades of Milk and Honey and Glamour in Glass.
Yes. So Shades of Milk and Honey, the way we pitched it was basically, it's like Jane Austen with magic. And the premise for me when I was creating it was that, you know, if Jane Austen had lived in a world where magic worked, she would probably write exactly the same sort of book, but there'd be magic in it, as opposed to Jane Austen writing a fantasy, which I don't think she would have done. So so the novel is basically two young ladies in love with the same man, young ladies of quality, all learn how to do glamour, which is a form of magic that is considered a womanly art, and you learn it the same way you are learning needlepoint or dancing or any of the other things like that. And
as a time-honored magical term.
Yes, it is.
Le Guin has used it, casting a glamour in her Earthsea books.
Oh, it's way older than that.
Yeah, yes. I didn't think she invented it. Yeah.
Which is one of the reasons that I picked it. So the idea with the book is, you know, that basically the first book is she going to get married? I mean, that's, you know, OMG, who's she going to marry with magic? And I tried to have the magic be integral to the plot, but it's a very intimate story. It's, you know, I tried to take fantasy and fit it into a Jane Austen plot mold.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no evil overlord, there's no, you know, the world is not at stake. Really the only thing that matters is, you know, is this girl going to get married? And part of what I like about Austen, and what she makes clear to me, reminds me of, is that there's so many things that can go wrong in a person's life that have nothing to do with world domination. And we tend to,
yeah.
you know, as writers, you're always told, you need to raise the stakes. And I think
oh,
a lot of people...
I'm so discreet.
Well, no, I think that you do need to raise the stakes, but I think that a lot of people try to raise the stakes by making the stakes externally larger.
Okay, well, yes.
And I think that what really people need to be doing is looking at how much it matters to the character. And that a lot of times raising the stakes means that you have not made it clear why the character should care,
yes.
and hence why the reader should care, which is something that Austen does beautifully.
Yeah.
I actually think I learned more about writing horror from Jane Austen than from anyone else, because she is the master of the fine detail.
That's interesting. That's very interesting. and I can see exactly what you're talking about.
So so I wanted to see if I could make fantasy do that, you know. In Persuasion, when you get to the proposal scene, doesn't matter how many times I've read it, I weep every single time.
Yeah.
And certainly, you know, I read science fiction and fantasy, and I gravitate to the stories that do that, that have that deep emotional truth, and that use the lens of science fiction and fantasy to get to that truth. But I want that emotional hit, and I wanted to see if I could do that on a small scale. If I could stay within a single family, within a single village, with nothing more important than, you know, is she going to get married? And in the Regency, that could make or break a woman's life.
Yeah.
Because she had so little control. She couldn't own property.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, I'm constantly watching, as I was learning my 19th century literature mm-hmm. through movies and all that, and watching with Barbara, and the, you know, watching, oh, I don't know, some Our Mutual Friend or something like mm-hmm. that. Why doesn't she just... Because a woman can't. It
yes.
doesn't. Why wouldn't they try to do it for the first time? It's unthought of.
Yeah.
You're thinking outside the bubble.
Mm-hmm. And that's something that has frustrated a lot of readers who have come at this from straight fantasy. One of the things that I'll see people say is, well, why doesn't she just tell him she loves him? And I'm like, it's 1814, and they're British. There's... no possible way that conversation would happen.
No, I'm sorry. That just sounds like, you know, that would be great on the book cover.
Right.
It's 1814, and they're British. Will this couple ever get together? But right there we have summarized
yes.
a lot of what's so much
yeah.
fun about this.
Oh,
and
thank you.
And you know what? I think that as a lover of science fiction fantasy, and so having had so much fun with mm-hmm. the first book, I think that you just pinpointed what it was, how they all work together.
Mm.
It's world making.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
It's world
making. Exactly what
it is. It's no different than, God help me, Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
In which the world has been created and you have to live within the confines.
Absolutely.
That exist, and then everything must follow logically.
You know, it's funny you say that, because one of the ways that when I was learning Regency etiquette for the books, which, you know, I get wrong sometimes, but when I was learning it, I kept thinking of it that it's actually kind of like a magic system.
Hmm.
You know, there's a clear set of rules, but then there's also all of this stuff that's implied.
Mm-hmm.
But if you violate the rules, there are grave, grave consequences. And, you know, and it's like, it's not that much different from figuring out a magic system where, you know, there's
yeah.
a set of rules. Some of it's implied. But if you violate them, grave, grave consequences. I'm sorry, you've just blown up your hand.
Yes, exactly. Or the threefold law applies. Yes. What you did out there comes back three
yes.
times. Or
yes, a gelatinous cube is attacking.
Exactly.
Yes.
So where does that bring us to with the new novel?
So Glamour and Glass is set in 1815, which is the year after the first one. And the thing that's wonderful about playing with history is that I can tell you some of the things that happen without being spoilers, because they're history.
Oh, good. Yes.
So in 1814, Napoleon goes into exile on the Isle of Elba. And lots of British citizens flocked to Europe because it was safe for the first time in, you know, a decade.
Yeah.
And then in 1815, Napoleon comes out of exile. He escapes, and there's this little thing called Waterloo. So if you happen to be a happily married couple who met in the first book and have gone on honeymoon in the second book,
mm-hmm.
you know, chaos ensues, as they
right.
say. What I wanted to do with the second book was...
And again, great blurb copy right there.
Oh, thank you. Honeymoon in Waterloo.
yeah, but I was thinking, if you are a couple...
Yes.
Napoleon is back. If you are a couple...
Yes.
Yeah.
Do not. But actually, one of the things that I was interested in doing with this... there were several things that I was interested in doing with this. One was... structurally, I wanted to see if I could write a sequel that was not a sequel. Because Jane Austen never wrote sequels.
Right.
So I am, you know, I am jumping off into, I have firmly left Austen land behind. It is, it's still the Regency. I still have characters that were born in a Jane Austen world, so there's still a lot of that flavor left, but it's much more swashbuckling.
Mm-hmm.
But because of that, I also knew that there were, I wanted it to be a book that people could pick up without having read the first one, and then go back to the first one and read it as a prequel. And there were several things that allowed me to do that, one of which was, you know, since my married couple is heading to the continent, that means that I could basically change my cast of characters, which meant you didn't need to know as much backstory.
Right.
And also because I was using actual history, I also did not need quite as much backstory as I would if I were writing a secondary world fantasy where I would need to explain all about Napoleon.
Previously on.
And then the second thing that I wanted to do thematically is, you know, Jane Austen's books are all about falling in love, getting married, you know, finding that the perfect person, mm-hmm. the love match. And what I wanted to do is explore what life is like for a newly married couple. You know, these, in all of these books, with the exception of Persuasion, the characters don't actually, well, no, that's not true. I take that back. Actually, most of her books, the characters do know each other for a long time. So, but frequently in romances.
Yeah, yeah. No, I was just thinking, but there often is that fellow just moved.
Yes,
from, you know, London.
Yeah, I mean, even Pride and Prejudice, they know each other for about a year, but the falling in love is often very sudden.
Yeah.
But anyway, point being, that what I was interested in was that period when you're newlyweds and finding the balance. And in this book, and here we get a little bit into spoilers because I am about to have to talk about who gets married in the first book.
Okay.
So in the first book, Jane, my main character, not Jane Austen, Jane Ellsworth, but Jane marries Mr. Vincent, who's a professional glamorist, and they begin a life of, you know, book two has them beginning a life as professional glamorists. So one of the things that that having her marry a professional glamorist and, you know, start a partnership where they're both working allows me to do is explore the role of women in society, because this is a period where women did not have professions. Gentle people in general did not have professions. You know, you were a landowner, maybe a lawyer, maybe a captain in the army or the navy, military career. But, you know, those were the options for men. There were no, you know, a woman, you know, just she didn't work. It was not that. It puts you in a completely different social setting. And obviously there are outliers, but generally speaking, it completely changes Jane's role. And she's also used to being the best glamorist in the neighborhood, and suddenly she's married one of the best people in England. And so it is very much about that reevaluation of self that goes through when you first get married, when you have a change in your life, and when you're trying to evaluate what it means, you know, your self-identity, and finding that balance between, you know, husband and wife. And one of the things that I wanted very specifically to do with this is, you know, frequently you read the book where there's a misunderstanding between the couple,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, and rather than just saying, hey, I think we didn't understand each other, let's work this out,
mm-hmm.
They are separated for the entire book and then come together dramatically at the end. And I wanted Jane and Vincent to be, you know, somewhat more realistic. I wanted them to, you know, I wanted them to have a fight and make up, you know? It's like, you know, I didn't like what you just did. That really annoyed me.
Mm-hmm.
And for him to go, oh, that's, all right, yeah, okay, I can see what you're doing. Yeah, I see how that's annoying. I'm used to working alone. Okay. And, you know, for him to say, I think you're overreacting. And for her to say, you're right, I am overreacting. And, you know, for headbutting to happen in between that, but for them to actually, you know, be grown-ups.
Act like people.
Yes, act like people. You know, people don't just get along all the time. People don't just fight all the time. I wanted that mix.
Yeah.
And then, of course, there's Waterloo and Napoleon.
Just thrown in for good measure.
Those, you know.
Well, maybe with all of that, maybe now is a good time for us to hear a little bit from the book. Now, we haven't discussed, we have alluded to the fact that Mary is a voice actor, but outside of Ellen Kushner, Mary Robin Cole, I don't really know how many other writers have been honored enough to read their own books. Both of them are good enough to read other people's books. And Mary teaches how to do this. I do a course which is sort of like how to be a really great amateur. I think I just realized the difference between what you teach and what I teach. I believe what I teach is how to be a really top amateur.
Interesting.
Because I'm dealing with people who are not going to be readers and all that. Whereas having taken your workshop, I now realize what you're doing is opening up people to the world of professionalism, even if you are an amateur.
Yes, and I do think that if you learn what the goal is, that even if you don't hit it, you at least know what you're aiming for, and that it will raise your performance regardless.
Yeah. So having said that, people should realize that this is just as good as any audio book. boasted over who he gets to read.
That's very kind of you.
And I'm going to move it away from me, which I probably should have done at the start of the interview. But
I'm going to read to you a little bit from Chapter 3, which actually is a scene that has some of that conflict that I was just talking about. So what you need to know leading up to this is that Jane and Vincent had been working on a commission for the Prince Regent, a glamural, and there was a party at the Carlton House, which is the Prince Regent's residency, and there was a small glitch with one of the glamours, which Vincent stayed behind to fix. And I think from here, you should be able to get everything else from context. Chapter 3, Flattery and Letters. As Jane waited for her husband at Carlton House, she eventually received word that she was to return to their apartments without him. The rest of the guests had long since departed, leaving her with only the company of Prinny and Lady Hertford. The gentlemen had been too much in their cups for conversation, and only Lady Hertford had made the hours tolerable. Jane's concern that she had caused some major damage to the glamural gradually changed to discomfort that she was keeping their hosts up so late, then to annoyance with Vincent for placing her in such an unpleasant position. The Prince Regent had been beyond gracious, even in his inebriated state, and had arranged for her to be returned home in his own carriage. The use of the prince's equipage would have been a matter of some excitement under other circumstances. As it was, Jane returned home in a less than pleasant mood. Though she had every expectation of seeing her family on the morrow, as they had come to London for the express purpose of taking in the Vincent's glamural with the rest of the public, she wished very much for her sister's company. When she was at home at Long Park Mead, Melody had long been her confidant, and understood Vincent the best out of Jane's family. But as the hour was far too late to call upon her relations, Jane began a letter to Melody in an attempt to ease her mind. She was on her third draft when Vincent returned to their rooms. His cheeks were drawn, and his face had the unhealthy flush which so often marks the remnant of exertion. Jane abandoned her letter, alarm replacing her upset, and sprang from her chair. "Vincent?" He sighed heavily. "I am quite well." "I do not believe you for a moment." Jane took him by the arm, and despite her smaller stature, led him easily to a wing-back chair by the tall casement window. Despite his protestations, the memory of his brush with death from an overexertion of glamour remained strong in her mind. Leaving him for a moment, she flung open the window to let in the night breeze and wove a simple glamour to help the breeze along, hoping that it would cool the fever evidenced by the ruddiness of his cheeks. So long as his art beckoned, Vincent would push himself too hard, like a racehorse, without a care for his health. He dropped without complaint into the chair and stretched his legs out in front of him, leaning his head against the chair back with a sigh. Jane stood behind him and leaned over to tug his cravat loose. Vincent reached up and caught her hand, bending his head to kiss the inside of her wrist. The warmth of his fever seemed to pulse through her veins, and, of a sudden, the room was too warm for her as well.
"My love, you must not work yourself so—"
"You have told me so before." He kissed her wrist again, but this was entirely your fault.
Jane snatched her hand out of his grasp. "I am sorry, but you may be certain it is not an error I will make again."
As unaffected as he was, she had not expected him to be so blunt in his response.
"Jane, Jane."
Vincent was out of his chair in a moment, and had her by both hands again. They trembled in his grasp, but Jane would not let herself cry when she had cause to be angry.
"What are you going on about?"
The knot that came untied on the fish."
Her throat was raw with swallowed tears.
"That is what you are correcting, is it not?"
"No, my love, no."
Vincent pulled her closer despite her resistance, and folded her into his arms. His voice rumbled against her cheek.
"Prinny loved your fish. He wanted me to make more of them. If you have a fault, it is in being too clever."
She pushed herself out of his arms.
"Then why did you do it alone instead of calling me?"
Vincent frowned, brows raising in confusion.
"Prinny asked me. You were with the ladies."
"I had no choice in that."
"Nor did I."
Vincent rumpled his hair so that it looked as if he were a madman.
"I could hardly call you back in. The room was filled with cigar smoke, and you witnessed the state of the prince."
"Yes, I endured the state of the prince for the next several hours. I am quite aware of it, and would have been more than happy to have had some reason to leave the drawing room."
"But you must see that it was the simplest course. Prinny explained what he wanted to have added, and it was not a task that required two glamorists."
"Since I created the fish, it should have fallen to me."
"I do not understand you."
All the upset she had felt as it became... All the upset she had felt transformed as it became clear that Vincent did not recognize how he had slighted her by altering her design without consultation.
I am vexed that you did not even do me the courtesy of telling me what the Prince Regent wanted. I might have lost your trust, but you could have at least told me so directly, instead of leaving me like a bauble in the drawing-room."
"My trust? I had no intention of slighting you. I just thought to spare you the effort. Indeed, it would have been more complicated to repeat his instructions. I could weave the fish with ease."
Her mind fixed on the word ease. Of course, a task which took her hours of concentration was of no difficulty to him. Jane knew she was being unjust in guessing his intentions, and yet the upset she felt was no less real for it. The flush of anger heated her cheeks, and Jane railed against that fault of her complexion which so easily laid bare her emotions. She pinched her lips together and made some effort to slow her breathing.
"Jane."
Vincent's voice trailed away at a loss. Hands held outward, half in entreaty, half in surrender, he said,
"Tell me what I have done."
Jane resolved to make some effort to explain, but her words came out more clipped and forceful than she had intended.
"The ballroom was to be our collaboration. To have you decide upon and make changes yourself makes me feel as though you have little regard for my skills or opinions. That the glamour you changed was one which I created makes—"
She crossed her arms over her chest, suddenly cold.
"I must assume that you have lost trust in me because the knot came untied."
"Knots do that."
He buried his hands in his hair, staring at her as if she were a perplexing strand of glamour.
"I have not lost trust in you, and certainly not for something as small as that. For heaven's sakes, Jane, I corrected an error during dinner myself."
"You never left the table."
"Well, no."
He had the grace to shift uncomfortably.
"I have some practice at repairs from the dinner table."
The way he dug his toe into the carpet put her in mind of a schoolboy caught out, and it quite undid her. Jane glared at him with mock severity.
"I heard from Sir Lumley about your exploit with the clock tower, so I do not know why I pretend surprise."
"Yes, well, well, I was not a nice boy."
"I might vouch for that."
This prompted a hurt expression, so at odds with his usual gruffness,
that Jane softened and slipped her hand into his. I did not mean it.
No, you are correct. I should have spoken with you about the changes. I'm used to working alone and have no practice at sharing responsibility.
Shaking his head, Vincent returned to the chair, drawing Jane down to sit upon his knee.
I will amend that.
Thank you. Jane kissed him on the forehead, which was still too warm for her liking. You should always call me, if for no other reason than that I might stop you from overworking yourself.
Smiling, Vincent leaned back against the chair. I work harder to try to match you than I do on my own.
Stop! She tweaked his nose. I will not listen to false flattery.
It is true!
She did not believe him, for all that she was unwillingly pleased by his praise. But how did you learn to work glamour from so far?
He cleared his throat. Remembering that I was not a nice boy, and bearing in mind that you love me now...
He paused to kiss her on the cheek.
You do love me now?
Very much. She leaned against his chest. Now continue.
When I was at home, my father forbade me to practice glamour because it was a woman's art. So I watched my sisters' lessons and learned what I could from them, simple as they were. But what I delighted in was to learn by unstitching glamours, so that I could get at their parts. I would take them apart, and then slowly learn to put them back together again. Not always with success.
That must have brought you into terrible trouble.
It did.
He grew quiet for a moment and caressed her hair, lost in memory.
I taught myself to work glamour from a distance, so that I could unstitch things while my sisters were standing near them. If I were stealthy, one of them would get the blame.
Jane pushed herself up and stared at him in astonishment. You did not!
I told you I was not a nice boy.
You did not say you were wicked!
His voice roughened. I would have thought you had learned that by now.
Rogue?
Muse.
They were occupied for some minutes then with duties marital. To disturb their privacy would be indecorous. Suffice to say, the Vincents were a healthy couple, and with their differences settled, they were happily matched in temperament.
That's lovely.
Thank you. One of the reviewers called that last line the most delicate sex scene ever written.
Yeah, I can see that. I can see that. It says just enough as we slowly pause the camera and pull the curtain down. Very cinematic.
Thank you.
Visual.
Thank you.
Very visual. And a lot of reading. Yay!
Oh, thank you so much.
Yeah, I'm sorry that I'm afraid we have room tone.
Yes, well.
There's no getting around that.
I mean,
we need to do studio. It was actually, you know, it wasn't that bad at my house except for the occasional bird.
Right.
Although birds with some of this work perfectly well. But here we do have house cleaning of
yes.
a hotel.
Yes.
And all that.
Well, when you have me in December, we will be very close to the release of the third book, and I can read that and preview it for you.
Well, why don't you just give us a little, you know,
not
just a little
tiny hint.
Tiny hint.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's called,
little hit.
Yes. It's called Without a Summer. So there are four books planned currently. Without a Summer is number three, and it takes place in 1816, and the thing that's great about 1816 is that it was historically called the Year Without a Summer because the volcano Tambora exploded and kicked so much ash into the air that almost globally, there was not something that was recognizably summer. In Washington, D.C., in July, it snowed. So,
oh, my.
So, The Year Without a Summer. So this book is called Without a Summer. I'm describing it as something like Jane Austen's Emma against the Luddite Rebellion. And although there was a Luddite Rebellion at this 1814, 1815, 1816 was kind of the last days.
Pitch.
Isn't that fun?
Yeah.
Luddites. I gotta love them. But the big problem that we run into in my universe is that cold mongers, who are glamorists who specialize in cold weaves to, you know, cool rooms, chill fruit, what have you, if you have a year without a summer, they're out of a job, so there are labor disputes. and uprisings.
Oh.
And so Jane and Vincent are in London, and there's a lot of that going on.
Mm-hmm.
Some, you know, so again, a little bit more swashbuckling.
Okay.
And fun also because I get to deal, you know, again, digging into areas that Austen never went, which is dealing with the underclass.
Yeah.
You know, the working class. So coldmongers are not...
This is just wonderful, fun stuff. I'm ready.
Excellent.
I'm there.
You want to hear about book four?
Oh, yes.
So book four, I'm just going to give you the title and the elevator pitch.
Okay.
It's called Valor and Vanity. I'm in the middle of plotting it right now, and almost finished, actually. And the elevator pitch for it is, Jane Austen writes Ocean's 11.
Ocean's 11 has no manners.
No. Well, kind of.
Yeah. Actually, yeah.
Yeah.
When you think about it is almost the mirror image.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And such a mirror image that, yes, the manners are there. It's the manners of a Rat Pack.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But, you know, and, actually that brings up a really interesting thing about the term manners.
Yes.
So, you know, one thing that there's a line in Pride and Prejudice that Darcy did not have manners calculated to please. You know, there was a difference in the Regency between manners and etiquette. Manners were considered an outward expression of your opinion of others. So to say that you had good manners meant that you thought well of everybody, or at least treated them like you thought well of them.
Mm-hmm.
Darcy did not have good manners, not because he did things that were against etiquette, but because by his very manner, you could tell that he looked down upon you.
Yeah, actually, his etiquette was fine.
His etiquette was perfectly fine.
Yeah.
Bingley had good manners because he just generally liked everybody.
Mm-hmm.
So the goal was to have good manners, and etiquette was more or less, and, you know, this is the period where conduct books are starting to first really make their appearance. There were some before, but, they're starting to become very popular. And in many ways, etiquette, you can look at it as a way to try to codify what good manners were.
Yeah.
You know, you should stand up for a lady. That's etiquette. But it's also good manners.
Indeed.
You know.
Indeed.
And it was possible in the Regency to have excellent etiquette, as Darcy did, with very poor manners.
Yeah. I love this stuff. I love the ideas.
Mm-hmm.
I love the language.
Mm.
I don't belong to a lot of listservs, but I will promote one, and it's a non-commercial one, called A Phrase a Week.
Mm-hmm.
And you can find it at, I think it's phrases.co.uk.
Mm-hmm.
And they will mail you every Thursday a phrase, and hopefully we'll find the derivation of it, often they cannot.
Yes.
And there's another one, Worldwide Words, in which they will just examine the etymology, and the etymology may be of an internet word, but more often than not, it's something else altogether.
Yeah.
And frequently, we're finding ourselves in the Regency.
Mm-hmm.
If it's not Shakespearean, then it's frequently a early 19th century phrase using a word in a different manner.
Yes.
Using that word again in a different way.
Yes.
There's a word with 40 meanings.
Oh,
way,
my goodness.
Manner, all of these things. And I love this stuff. And especially when you get into things like Raining Cats and Dogs.
Oh, yeah,
or
yeah.
All this. But it's especially wonderful in the Regency.
Well, I did a really crazy thing with Glamour and Glass.
Mm-hmm.
Which is I had some anachronisms in Shades of Milk and Honey and the language, which annoy me. And, you know, I try to get them out. But
this is hindsight, yeah.
So I misused the word check, which is corrected in the paperback book, which meant stop, you know. So, I shall check on the strawberries. No, that means I shall stop on the strawberries. It's not useful. So, what I did for Glamour and Glass...
Ah, I see, yes.
...is that I created a Jane Austen word list. I took the complete works of Jane Austen, ran them through a generator which returned a unique list of words, which I used as my spell checker. And it flagged every word that Jane Austen did not use. which then allowed me to look up whether or not that word existed. And I used the Oxford Historical Thesaurus, which for the word geeks out there is just so sexy.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
It's like, for those of you who are not familiar with it, you need to, the New York Public Library card will get you in.
The Oxford is the O word. It's absolutely.
The Historical Thesaurus gives you a list of synonyms in the order in which they appeared in the language, and shows you a sample of them in use.
Oh my God.
So yeah, it's so good.
Oh my God.
It's so good. So I would look up the words that Austin didn't use to see if they existed, and if the meaning had shifted, and if it did, then I tried to pick a word that was understandable to a modern audience, because I always have to remember that I'm writing for modern readers, but that was appropriate to the period. And it was really amazing to me how many words were coming into the language right in this period. You know, there were words that were, and you know, they probably existed. They probably were in use before they first appear in the print, because all.
But what they do at Oxford and in these things that I cited, which, by the way, are Oxford related, both of these things, these newsletters, is they look for the first printed citation.
Yes.
You can prove nothing before that.
Yes. And
They often disprove that things are earlier, like, what is it, Saved by the Bell.
Mm.
An urban legend has it that people were afraid in Victorian times of being buried alive.
Right.
So they put bells on coffins and all that in case they woke up.
Well, they did do that.
That did happen, but the phrase Saved by the Bell did not come from that whatsoever. The first printed version of Saved by the Bell is Damon Runyon from a boxing match.
No kidding.
And so
that makes
there goes
much more sense.
Yep. There goes a myth.
Yep.
So it's also dispelling.
Yes, absolutely. And so I would
I love it.
Oh, me too.
Oh, yeah.
So I would use that, and I also used Google Books, which allows you to search for a phrase and then and narrow it to within a window. So I was basically searching a 15-year period, 15 or 20-year period. And then the other one I used was Google Ngrams. So if you've got two words, and I totally geek out on this stuff.
I forgot about that.
Oh, so good. Because you can plug in two words and see which one was more popular.
There was. I'm sorry, I'm going to geek for a second. Mm-hmm. There was a day when anything Google was everything good,
mm-hmm.
where you had these wonderful, quirky little services and programs and all that, and that was under one person who was operating Google, but coming underneath with one of the creators, and I think the current, he's the current Ubermensch of Google, is the idea of, no, we have to make this all work together, and it's all got to have a purpose. And one of the things I loved about Google is that it need have no purpose other than to be cool.
They had
I am the world's strongest Google advocate. I know you're a pretty strong one as well.
Well, I use it heavily, although they got rid of one of my favorite tools, which was Google Timeline. And I used it all the time.
Google Notebook was my favorite. What's the term? The euphemistic term they used, that they sunsetted.
Mm-hmm.
They sunsetted the program.
Yes, I was very disappointed when Timeline
went away. And then Timeline was,
incredibly useful.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so I keep hoping that someone will come up with something like it.
But, you know, with all of the controversy, which no doubt as CEFWA vice president, you had to deal with in terms of some of the projects.
Mm-hmm.
Which are double-edged swords.
Yes.
That Google is wielding.
Oh, yeah.
Because the idea of scan it all is theoretically lovely,
mm-hmm.
when you don't think about whose heads you're stomping on as you do it, so that you can do what you did there, which is so wonderful, is be able to find the phrases.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That were used.
Yes.
I had another side of that. But I've lost. But it's okay. But I also express some of it is as long as you're not trotting. I mean, there is no thing cooler than Google Maps Street View.
Oh, yeah.
Until you show who's in that window.
But, yeah.
And actually, they never did that, but there have been oopses.
Yeah. But it's, these tools are, they're tools, and what you do with them is like any tool.
You can
kill someone with a fork.
Well, yeah, you can kill someone with a fork or...
And there are times I've wanted to.
Yeah, Adam Eel, no doubt. What, okay, so now I think I've gotten a lovely image of the scope.
Hmm.
Short stories. You're a wonderful short story writer.
Thank you.
And you have many different, literally, many different voices within short stories. And obviously, with wearing all of these hats, short stories have had to take a bit of a hit. But...
When I actually count up the number of words that I wrote last year, it's, my word count is definitely up. They have taken some, I don't know that it's not so much that they've taken a hit, it's that I'm much more likely to be writing things by invitation rather than writing things on spec. So,
and you've achieved a point in your career where you're getting those invitations.
Yes, which is very, very nice. I do, being able to sit down and just write something for the sheer fun of it. Is something I don't get to do as often. I certainly enjoy writing, don't get me wrong. But just like, where is this idea gonna go? I don't get to do that quite as often. I am working on an audio novelette right now. My novella is up for a Hugo.
That's right.
And that's science fiction,
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
Science fiction murder mystery. Kiss Me Twice.
That was so much fun.
Thank you.
And I still have my recording, I'm so proud, of Evil Robot Monkey.
Thank you, yes.
And you recorded that elsewhere? Or is it mine? In which case we have to, link to it for your website or something.
I can't remember if I did a recording of that from my website or not.
Yeah, if not, I mean, the recording you did for us, and that was studio.
Yeah.
Of course, that's when you were on the show live.
Yes.
And that was studio. That's a good quality recording, albeit a live recording. But I, since it's one of my I'm infamous for my taped recordings. I have 5 unlabeled shopping bags of cassettes.
Wow.
And then 5 shelves of reel-to-reel from 40 years ago. Not just mine, but Baird Searles and Take Notes of Anthony Boucher's tapes. Mm. I have all of his tapes.
Wow.
Well, all of those existing.
Right.
But my digital are accessible.
Yes.
So we could... I could just clip that.
Oh, that'd be great.
And either put that up somewhere or mail it to you or something.
If you put it up, I'll link to it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I should. So, would you call this a transitional point for you?
Oh, yeah.
A new book out, new book coming, and what was the term you were... Rotating off.
Yes, rotating off the
as Mary Robin Akual rotates off.
Yes, well, doing that.
That's a horrible image. I'm gonna.
No. it's definitely a heavy transitional period because moving.
Chicago,
changing from.
Say hi to Bill Shun.
Will do.
Yeah,
absolutely. Changing from puppetry is my main. As my day job to writing as my day job, which has been this slow transition over the past couple of years. Definitely a time of transition.
Yeah. Well, it's an exciting one. It sounds all positive.
Mm-hmm. I'm enjoying it.
And your fans are enjoying it as well.
I hope so.
I think so, yeah. I'm triangulating here. Having spent all this weekend talking to people, your name has come up.
Oh, that's nice of you.
In such a positive way from so many people.
People are nice.
Yeah.
Generally speaking.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the time.
Okay. I don't know how many interviews.
You have been listening to a recorded interview with Mary Robinette Kowal. The last name K-O-W-A-L. And Google her up to get some of her online fiction and various readings and things you can order. And thank you, Mary. She'll be back on this program live in December. And thank you for listening. This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. I'll be back next week at 1:30 in the morning. Thursday will be our next reading, location, and various things like that to be announced. So check in on the website. Have a good morning. Have a wonderful week. Enjoy the cool weather. Take care. And stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn. Clappers with Lister coming your way over these same airwaves in just a few moments.
Burn, baby, burn. Burn, baby, burn. hate this. These are the places we'll hit.
Number one,
Panama, talking about Peru, Azania, Brixton, Belfast, can't forget Korea, Beirut, can't forget Haiti, Iran, Puerto Rico, Colombia, Mexico, talk about Uptown, Harlem, New York City, y'all, and Nicaragua, East and South Central LA, California, IA, Miami, do or die, Bed-Stuy, never ran, never will, Brownsville, boogie down, South Bronx, yeah.
My man Joey to jail, and now they got him in court because he burned the flag. That's the name of the game. Well, I quit playing. I doubt the suckers want you to hear what I'm saying about this nation. Freedom supposed to be the format, but I step on your flag like it's a floor mat. Maim and mangle, the star spangle. I'm not trying to diss you. I use the flag like toilet tissue to wipe my black ass. What? You think that I'm a jackass? I see a flag and I attack fast with some fire. My desire to burn what Betty Ross sold up. The truth I show up about America, America, home. Land the free, boom, this is the home of the slave. Now hold on just a mother minute. You gave me freedom of speech in the First Amendment. So why wanna scold me when I touch the flag? I'm only doing what you told me. You don't like it, so what? I'm not scared of you. Your flag, America too. See, I made up this new rule and I want y'all to learn it. Strike a match to the American flag and burn.
We no want no more bother. We don't want the youths and try to poop on one another. Hear me calling Gaza. The youths them out there living wild, acting like a little child. All them so uncivilized. When them are gonna realize, with them want out of life. Is it the gun or the knife? Police are use all device. People youths are losing life. You kids are get scrutinized. Be careful and minimize.
Thursday, talk on a Friday, have fun on a Saturday, a lick me back on a Sunday, 9 to 5 on a Monday.
Yeah.
I don't lie.
99.5.
I don't lie.
List a lie.
Yeah. I don't lie. It's a Monday.
At exactly 10 minutes after the hour, 10 minutes after flag burning time, right here, 99.5, list a lie. WBAI. Robert Knight on the case at 6 o'clock. Sitting in for Esther. One hell of a show waiting for you at 5 o'clock. Actually, 6 o'clock, 5 o'clock shadow, the very best. Robert Knight. Wake up call, brand new. Yeah. One of Robert Knight's favorite Michael Rose tunes. Listen to these lyrics, no gimmicks. The artist who was first on the imperialist terrorist list. Yeah. As an artist. Hear this.
The mark of the beast is on a president.
His imperialist majesty Barack the First. Yes, I am. A right-wing imperialist.
Round the bend, testing supernatural force. While babies with open mouth, Allah and Sean.
Flag burners of the world unite. We burn the red, white and blue, all glory imperialist flag straight to asses and proud of it. Sink of the fence can't hold. Yo, who's got the fire? Who's got the weed? Who's got the sense of mania? The hydroponic. His imperialist majesty Barack the First. The fence can't hold. Burn, baby, burn. List Alive 99 Sync of globalizing flag burning. Yes, I.